This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another spectacular edition of the Sellers Points Podcast. And we have a really good show for you today. This is one that we've talked about doing before, and it's going to be a nice little bit of symmetry with our hard-traveling fanboy cohorts, because we're going to be talking about a little movie some of you might be familiar with in our second half. But before we get to that, I have to introduce you all once again to my wonderful co-host and ginger polar bear, Mr. Kelly Poole. How you doing tonight?
Good. Yeah. How are you?
Man, I'm doing all right for a Tuesday night. You know, it's the week leading into Christmas, so you know how things go. You try to get as much done around the office as you can, and try to get all the little things taken care of, and it still feels like that just never-ending march towards a holiday. and of course it's, you know, Christmas shopping season, so everybody's out. It's a pretty miserable experience trying to go out and do anything anywhere. But you know, maybe one day everyone will discover the beauty of online shopping for their for a lot of their retail needs, except for comics. You guys have got to go. Yeah. You got to go to the comic shops and buy stuff there. Anybody else? Nah, we don't care.
I did all my shopping online, but I did everything else I've done locally here, like you're talking about with you know, comics and so forth. So,
same for me. I bought a couple of gifts for some folks at the local comic shop. Made sure to support my local businesses, as we especially need to remember to do around this time of year. But moving on from that, it was another good couple of weeks of comics, and I know that we both found some things to like, even though I don't know, for me there were a few issues that I was expecting a little bit more out of, and it seems like a lot of the stuff I've been reading in its current story arcs, they all kind of hit middle chapters, and whenever you hit that, it's kind of a lull period where they slowly building the story into something or adding like a little bit more groundwork, so there's not a ton of interesting stuff going on.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the case for a lot of the books I was reading over the last 2 weeks. But to tease the folks a little bit before we get to all that, this is another episode of The Missed and the Maligned. And what that means, of course, for all you loyal listeners out there, is we take a look at a piece of media, be it a comic story or a comic-based movie, TV show, that maybe people just missed out on, or maybe one that people just really hated, and we examine it to see if it earned that hatred or if it should have been missed. Maybe it shouldn't have been. But that's the general idea of this one, and we're going to be taking a look at the 2009 Zack Snyder-directed Watchmen in our second half, and we're going to be joined by a very special guest that we will be introducing to you in the second half. He's no stranger to the Sellers Points Podcast, has been here before, back in the days, actually back before Kelly joined the show. So you guys hang around for that one in the second half. But before we get to all that, we got to talk shop, and Kelly, that's what we do. So why don't we tell the people a little bit about what we've been reading out of DC Rebirth in our segment, the DC Rebirth Rapport. So, Kelly, what stuck out to you in some DC Rebirth the last couple weeks?
I read a lot. I mean, you know, if you listened a couple weeks ago, I think I went a couple weeks without getting my books.
Yes, you did.
got Slacker. Behind a bit. Well, you know what? When you have to pay bills, and I hate to say that I am a responsible adult, so you know, bills get paid first, and then my wants kind of come second. So I had to kind of wait on my comics. But hey,
or
you
sometimes
know,
not at all.
Yeah, but I went in and picked them all up. But there were a few that really stood out. I can't. Wonder Woman to me is, I mean, like every issue that comes out is just another just great story. And to me, I feel like I've been going through this whole process with Diana as far as her quest that she's on now and trying to figure things out. And I just love this book. I cannot say to me, this has been one of the pinnacles of the DC Rebirth. I mean, even I have to say, even though, I mean, what they've done with Hal and all the stuff that he's done, you know, I want to say, I think Wonder Woman's kind of, if they were neck and neck, she's just a few. I mean, she's kind of surpassed his book as far as, because it's just been phenomenal. I mean,
it's hard to argue with that.
The art's beautiful, and the writing is awesome. You know, the only thing I think that I would have to kind of give some negativity to, and it's not anything in course of the book. It's this these things that they've put in here, these fold out things for Justice League and Suicide was, you know, yeah, I was like, that's kind of annoying, but I get it, you know.
Yeah, they're trying to promote their big event, which actually starts this week. By the time you guys are hearing this, Justice League versus Suicide Squad number one will be out.
Yeah.
But in all the books for last week, they put in that giant, like, 8-page fold-out insert advertising their event. And, yeah, the fold-out spread of all the villains was kind of cool, but
it's nice, but it's cumbersome in a book.
Yeah, it is. And it makes the book fold kind of like sit in a weird way, even in the bags.
Like, yeah,
I
did like
the bulge.
Emerald Empress is shown significantly right there. If it's Lady in Green, if you don't know who she is, folks, but she is a Legion villain and a member of the Fatal Five, so that's kind of exciting. But she looks like she's part of this Suicide Squad thing, so I'm going to have to.
Yeah,
I wasn't planning picking it up, but now I may because she's in it.
They know how to appeal to Kelly's Legionnaire heart.
Yeah, if you stick anything in there Legion-wise, I'm like, oh, we got him.
Then you should totally be buying Batman because apparently Saturn Girl is locked up in Arkham Asylum.
Oh. Well, I have been reading Detective. I did pick that back up. So, I mean, or did you say Batman?
Yeah, it's in Batman. Like she appeared recently in the I Am Suicide story that's running right now. Batman visited Arkham Asylum, and they had this. They showed this girl in her her cell, and of course they have glass doors. They don't have traditional bars or anything. And she fogs over the glass with her breath, and then draws the Legion symbol in it. So I was like, "Yep, Saturn Girl's locked away in Arkham Asylum because they think she's crazy." But anyway, the Wonder Woman number 12. That was the. Next to last issue of year one. And, of course, they reveal Ares as the villain. No big surprise there. He's on the cover.
Yeah.
And we kind of figured that was coming. But the issue was gorgeous. It was another, like, just amazing issue from Nicola Scott. I hate that she's going to be walking away from Wonder Woman after the year one stuff is finished. But she's got another book called Black Magic that she's doing with Greg Rucka over at Image, and she's got to get back to that because they've had that book on hiatus for a while. But I'm totally with you on Wonder Woman. It has been a fantastic read every couple of weeks, and that's another thing I'm glad to see for it is that it's every 2 weeks we get another issue. One book that you and I both agree on, though, speaking of I think probably like your second favorite book and definitely a book in my top five for Rebirth That's Hal Jordan in the Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah.
Issue 10, I don't know if you picked up on this, but you probably did, but that scene inside the quote-unquote afterlife, that was reminiscent of some stuff we saw back in Blackest Night.
Yeah, it did kind of feel that way when I was reading it, you know.
It felt like a chapter, maybe a lost chapter of Blackest Night, with Hal talking to all these dead Green Lanterns who, you know, were basically very welcoming of him into this place where apparently all dead Green Lanterns go if they die, like, in the service of the Corps. And I think the part that really got to me, though, was Tomar Rae asking about his son. When Hal tells him about that, dude, I was tearing up a little bit. That was a very moving scene, even though it's very short. It was still just one of those things where, you know, it reminded you that, you know, Hal really is, you know, a grown-up here. He really is a leader of this Corps and still feels that way about it. He took on a very, like, commanding general pose. But also somebody who was, you know, talking to a long-lost friend. It was just a beautiful scene. And I think it was one of the best drawn issues so far of this series. And
yeah.
What a powerful set of circumstances that they've put the whole thing in. But I guess it's not really a spoiler since they've said who the real villain of this arc is in the solicits. What do you think about that last page reveal?
That was pretty cool. I mean, I didn't really, it kind of caught me off guard. So, I mean, I kind of liked that. And I really liked the interaction between guardian, the two guardians, and
Saeed and Ganthet.
Yeah, Ganthet and Saeed and sorry, my mind's all.
It's been a long day for Kelly, folks. But
a long day. But Kyle, for the White Lantern.
You can be forgiven for forgetting Kyle, because most of us would like to. But I'm just kidding.
I love Kyle.
I'm just kidding, Kyle Rayner fans. Y'all know I like to rib. But
it was good. It was good to see him, and he almost came back in this kind of like. I just kind of felt from the word from the just. His dialogue is like, what do you want? You know, that kind of.
Yeah, he was being a bit of a brat there for a second, but they pull him out of it. You know, luckily, so Robert Venditti doesn't write Kyle as a complete tool or anything. I felt like of course it was going to be necessary because it seemed like Hal was dead, and if you're going to bring somebody, you know, out of the realm of the dead, you're going to need the White Lantern. So it made sense to have Kyle there. And I got to tell you that the last page reveal is what got me. It just made so much sense. I was like, whoever thought of this idea of putting those two characters together, that is just brilliant. That is what I'm talking about. Within Rebirth, like these big ideas that we've always wanted to see, and that was really one of them. And I know the last thing to touch on before we move on from DC is we all know that the whole Justice League versus Suicide Squad thing is starting up, and I am still reading Suicide Squad, though I'm running out of reasons to keep doing it because issue 8. Closes out their, I guess this is would be the end of their first big story arc, and honestly it didn't really get any better as this has gone along. The dialogue is still just kind of there's not really any kind of big deal to it. There's often kind of back and forth characterizations that sometimes make sense and most of the time don't. And as a Justice League versus Suicide Squad prelude, I know it says that, but there's nothing in here that says prelude to me other than the backup story about Killer Frost, which was actually a pretty good story overall. I enjoyed that more than the main feature, and I thought that the artwork on the backup, and I know this is gonna hurt some people's feelings who are like big Jim Lee fans, but his art has not been at his best throughout this opening arc of Suicide Squad. And honestly, I feel like maybe some of his creative input is dragging the series down, because I noticed that as soon as he's out of the picture and you've got Rob Williams, the writer, working with any other artist, the writing seems to improve. And that just kind of blows my mind that it's that way. But if you want to see the first DC Rebirth appearance of Killer Frost, it's in Suicide Squad number 8, and it is actually a pretty good story, but I think you could be forgiven for not having read this, and instead just skip over to Justice League versus Suicide Squad number 1, which is out now. So that being the, I know Kelly, you haven't been reading Suicide Squad, have you?
No. What I was going to ask, with this is her first appearance as far as the new the DC Rebirth. Are they doing it similar to Caitlin Frost on Flash, or is it kind of, you know?
She's like a cross between that and her classic version.
Yeah.
So she has killed people. She has, you know, earned the name Killer Frost. Mm-hmm. But they do play her as a bit more of a sympathetic character than you would normally see of Killer Frost in comics. So it's like Rob Williams is kind of marrying the two ideas. And it actually does work pretty well. I enjoyed this characterization of Caitlin Snow. And I think there's going to be a real breakout moment for her in Justice League versus Suicide Squad. I think that she's going to be one of those standout characters, because, of course, she's going to be a member of the upcoming Justice League of America series.
I was just about to make that comment. I was like, well, she's supposed to be in that new series, which...
Yep. You know. She will be a member of the JLA, and I think they're putting her on the path of that redemption arc. That's where she's headed, and I think that's a good direction for this version of the character. There is room to work in that arena, and I feel like Rob Williams kind of laid a decent little intro groundwork there.
Yeah.
But we'll see if Josh... I've read the preview pages of Justice League versus Suicide Squad, and I already like Joshua Williams's take much better. Or Joshua Williamson. I like his take better than I liked Rob Williams on Suicide Squad. So...
Is Jim Lee, is he doing the art for Suicide Squad, or is he doing...
I don't think he's on it past issue 8. Because Riley Rossmo is coming on to do the Justice League versus Suicide Squad tie-in issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be a different artist, and that may elevate the quality of the book. I got to say that it's going to take a whole lot of turnaround in order for me to want to stick with it. Mostly because I'm just not feeling how Harley Quinn has been written up to this point. I don't feel like Rob has a good handle on her voice. And whenever I read something like the recent DC holiday special issue when Paul Dini was back to writing Harley Quinn, that just reminded me of how well she can be written and how she should be written. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like Rob just doesn't get it. He writes many of the other characters really well. Like, I like how he does Killer Croc. When he's writing Deadshot as a like central focal character, I like that. I like how he writes Amanda Waller. And I do like how he writes Captain Boomerang. He does capture a good voice there, and I'm glad that he's back. But this new villain or new character they've introduced named Hack is about as useless as they come. So,
is he a throwaway character?
No, she is a. She is a Harley Quinn fan who has the ability to travel via internet. Like, she can digitize herself and other people and, like, travel that way, which is... And she can, like, break into any computer as a result of this ability. So she'd be a good foil for maybe Cyborg, but this whole, like, her trying to emulate Harley Quinn and the fact that she's... apparently she's English because she uses a lot of British slang.
Yeah.
Or at least she started to, and it was not made expressly clear that she was British. So whenever she started using British slang, I was like, what is this? Like, why is she talking like that? Who talks like that if they're American? And wait. Oh, then they reveal later, oh, she is British. Okay. Maybe should have led with that.
Yeah.
That would have made her speech patterns a little bit clearer, at least to me. But anyway, but I digress. Maybe she'll be expendable. Maybe they'll detonate that bomb in her head. there's also a tease of Caitlin Snow developing a bit of a crush on El Diablo. And I kind of dig that since she is being portrayed as what they describe as a heat vampire. She sucks the heat out of people and forms it into cold.
Ah, okay.
I was like, oh, well, El Diablo might actually be a good matchup for her. Might make her a little hot under the collar. But I digress. We're gonna move on to our marvelous moments where we talk about a little bit of stuff from Marvel. And I do have one book that I wanted to mention. Not want to say too much because I feel like it's been covered pretty well over on Hard Travel Fanboys. Because Nick Duke and I are both big fans of this book. It's The Unworthy Thor. Issue 2 really kicked things into high gear, revealed a big villain, and had a nightmare scene that brought us all the way back to the beginning of Jason Aaron's Thor run, and had the main villain from that series show back up. Even if it is just in a nightmare scene, just seeing that again, and having it as a nice callback and a nice tie into this series was just outstanding. And on top of that, you've got Olivier Coppiel on art. And next to Asad Ribic, this guy might actually be my favorite Thor artist. There have been a lot of people who have drawn Thor really well over the years. But, wow, this is one damn fine-looking book.
Yeah.
Just tremendous art from beginning to end. And of course I loved the scene of just showing how evil the Collector is. There's a moment in this that you think the danger is past, and then they hit you with this like really shocking moment to me anyway. And man, it was kind of a gut punch. Honestly, even though the character involved was not somebody that I really had any connection to or anything, just seeing how straight up evil this guy is, that it'll give you a pause for a second, because dear God. But anyway, yes, this ends on a nice cliffhanger as well. Another big villain is about to enter the playing field, and I'm really curious as to how that's going to play with the Odinson, and how it also looks like I think we know how he's going to become worthy again. I think they may have tipped their hand a little bit in this issue, but they still haven't fully revealed what Nick Fury said to him to make him unworthy, though they do drop a few more hints about what it might have been.
They need to just... That was Original Sin. That was like 3 or 4 years ago. They need to link that up and finally let us know what the hell he said to him. Because that...
I really believe that's coming by the end of this 5-issue miniseries. That's got to be what they're building to. Because
it's got to make sense, too. It's got to be something that, you know, okay, we can go back to looking at that page and that panel when we first saw it and said, what did he say to him? And then... Now come to this point where we know what it is, and it all connects and clicks.
And with the reveal that Mjolnir is actually a sentient being, but not, like, omnipotent, that kind of says that Thor could have kept something from the hammer, or maybe something it didn't, that neither of them knew about. There are several avenues they can take, and that's why I'm glad I'm reading both series, Mighty Thor and Unworthy Thor, so that I can get that that full picture, because they really are kind of telling you both sides of the story that you're going to need to know about the time for when it actually gets to that point. And if they've written themselves the kind of out I think they have, then you could conceivably have two Thors running around in the Marvel Universe. Possibly. Which is an idea that Jason Aaron teased back during Secret Wars whenever their tie-in book Thors had the Thor of, like, every single universe brought together as the police force of that patchwork world. But anyway, Kelly, you had a Marvel book that I was really curious to get your thoughts on. I haven't read it, but I know that you were itching to talk about this one, so let's get to that.
Well, which one? There's three.
Oh, there's three.
Was it Hawkeye?
Oh, yeah. The one that you were a big fan of, and I was like, okay, I want to know what Kelly thought.
This Kate Bishop is back again as Hawkeye, and she's kind of one to do kind of the Jessica Jones thing. She's kind of doing the street level crusade, and just, she's doing it in such a fun way. I mean, she's just, you know, the art fits. At first I wasn't really that keen on the art, but then once I reread it a second time, I was like, this fits. This is kind of reminiscent of back when I think Matt Fraction did his first Hawkeye series, where they were kind of being the urban Avenger basically, and wasn't, you know, he was wearing just minimal costume and just, you know, but you know, this first story arc, she's got this one client that comes and she's, you know, got a stalker and she needs help, and Kate kind of goes out and does some research and does some and I mean, it was just a fun read for a first issue. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of explosions or, you know, bombastic action. It was just kind of a slow kind of burn where they're just kind of setting up, I guess, what's going to be kind of the way the series is going to be, you know, kind of a, like I said, an urban street level series where, you know, she's going to be out there doing investigating and doing kind of the Jessica Jones thing.
For people that may not know who Kate is, do you think that it was a good intro to her character? Could you just, you know, jump in here without having read any of that stuff?
In the first page, they've got it's the California Bureau of Security and Investigative Services private investigator application for license. And basically, it just kind of tells a little bit about Kate. You know, I mean, it doesn't. I would say, you know, that's a good point. I think for someone who doesn't have any clue who Hawkeye is, I don't think this would be a bad issue to get into. Of course, they're going to go in thinking that she's, you know, she's always been Hawkeye and there's never been Clint Barton. But
I assume that I assume Clint's not really in this book.
No, he hasn't been so as of yet. I mean, it looks like it's just her, which I'm fine with that. You know, I think Clint's in that Occupy Avengers book that I decided not to pick up. But this book, like I said, it was a fun read. It's not going to, I hate to be pessimistic. It may go 8 to 12 issues and then we'll probably see it close out, in typical Marvel fashion. But I'm sure that, you know, the 8 to 12 issues they end up doing are going to be phenomenal and be fine. But of course, it's going to float under the radar, and I don't see it, you know, I don't see it making it, I hate to say, but that's just, that's 10 plus years of being, you know, in the business like I was. And you pick up a sixth sense about things. And I was pretty much right on the money. You posted something on Facebook about Marvel titles that have already been axed. And, yeah. You know, looking through those, Vision was number one, but Vision was one that I read and I knew. I said, it's going to go less than a year. And I was pretty much right on the money. Hate to say. I mean, I don't want these books to get canceled. Please don't take my pessimism for this is what I want. I just know how it works, and the fact that it's unfortunate that this is kind of the way comics are now, that they'll give people titles and there's just not enough people that really care enough to pick them up, or like we said a few episodes back, they're too scared to try something new. And so, like I said, I would encourage anybody who's a Marvel fan that, you know, pick this book up. It's an excellent book. If you've got room in your subscription list, I'd definitely grab it. You know, it's definitely worth it, you know.
And it is something, you know, because Marvel has a lot of good solo hero books. I'm not real big on a lot of their team-up books, but the majority of the solo character stuff I've read has been very good. And Hawkeye is one that caught my eye. I did want to read that. And kind of in fairness to what the Vision situation was, Tom King, who is writing that book, did sign an exclusive contract with DC. So he had to close Vision out. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Marvel had to cancel the book. They could have handed it off to a different creative team. But they chose to cancel it instead, and they may relaunch it, because that seems to be the way things go with Marvel now. Is no pun intended there, but they seem to run a book for about 12 to 15 issues, then they do some kind of big event that causes a line wide relaunch, and they start things back over at number one. Maybe they change creative teams, maybe they don't. But that seems to be the pattern that we're seeing with Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
I mean, it's repeated itself a couple of times now. And
I would rather them just say, okay, look, you know, just call them miniseries. Just give people what it is, you know, be honest with them. And not saying, let me say ongoing, you think, you know, exactly what that word says, ongoing. And when you get nixed after eight issues or even less than a year, you know, the folks are like, okay, well, this sucks. Why did this happen? Well, low numbers. Anytime a book gets canceled, it's because of money, you know, for the most part.
Usually. You know? There are a few exceptions there. But
yeah.
I'd say with Marvel, it's like they seem to have subscribed to this idea that was bandied about by, I want to say it was Mark Waid that said this idea that comics should be treated like TV seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Like you go so many issues and then you start over back at like a number one, but you allow it to keep going, keep telling the story with those characters.
Yeah.
Or with that, maybe with those creative teams and those ideas. But I do think that the day maybe over that you see Marvel books reach into the, you know, much past the 20s or into the into the 30s. Like Amazing Spider-Man is going to hit 25, and maybe a few other books will as well. But
there'll be a few. I mean, we don't. That'll never happen again. We're never going to see
Marvel
book hit the 50 mark or the 100 mark.
Yeah, I don't see that happening anymore. It's kind of interesting that I feel like DC has a much better chance of that happening with their books than
they do
has with Marvel. Like I feel like Marvel is rebooting far more often, not really rebooting, but relaunching far more often. And
that that can either be a good or a bad thing to an extent. I mean, for sales wise, I mean, you could get new people every time and they're okay with that. But for me, you know, as an older reader and somebody that's been reading forever, it kind of gets a little exhausting. I mean, like if they launch another Vision book, like you were describing as a possibility, yeah, I'll probably go and pick it up. But you kind of get tired of seeing things that you enjoy reading getting axed. You know, that's kind of, you know, I go into a lot of books like that, like I did with Squadron Supreme. You know, I said, this book is, if it goes to 8 issues, I'll be surprised. But, you know, it's just like getting the rug pulled out from underneath you. I mean, I kind of know it's going to get pulled, but it doesn't mean I enjoy it.
Yeah, I certainly don't enjoy that either. Even as, you know, I'm a bit of a younger fan than what you are, so I'm a little more used to the idea and can kind of roll with it. But
yeah,
at the same time, it does get a little irritating to see a book that I've been collecting for so long, all of a sudden it just stops. And you know, if I weren't keeping up so closely with all the news reports and everything through different comic book media sites, I might not have any idea that a relaunch was coming, or that this was all just about, you know, changing creative teams. Which is both, you know, there are pros and cons to that as well. But that's neither here nor there. You know, I'm sure that, you know, Marvel will continue to have success, because it does seem like every time they relaunch and they go, you know, to a bunch of new number ones, those new number ones are like in the top 10 selling books.
Yeah.
Every time they do it. And that's kind of how they seem to recapture their market share, is by launching those new number ones or having an event book going. Because as soon as those events start, man, shops order heavy on them, I guess because they sell. I mean, the pattern seems to be shops order real heavy on all of these events, and there must be something to it, because they keep doing it. It's not like they, you know, if there was a low selling event out there from Marvel, I don't know about it. I mean, even Civil War II, which has not been all that well received, is still selling just fine. Its numbers are nowhere near bad. I mean, its reviews could be a lot better, but people are buying it.
Yeah.
So that's the pattern. That's what we do. That's what we see, and what we deal with from the Marvel side of the house.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of miss those days of seeing books kind of carry on, but I do get where you're coming from. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, Marvel knows how to get people excited about books. And I have to say, I get caught up in it too. When I see a new lineup of new number ones that they're doing, and there's these new series, and maybe they're giving, you know, a C-list character their own book, or, you know, a low B character his own book or her own book. I'm like, oh, I know that character. I might read that. You know, I mean,
and it's hard to resist sometimes, especially that X-Men line that's coming up. Yeah. I'm having a hard time not being like, try all the things.
try all the
X books. I'm like, I can't afford that.
No, I've narrowed it down. I'm going to do Generation X, and I'm going to do the blue team for X-Men. And I said that I was going to probably pick up Jean Grey and Iceman. I've just nixed that idea. So I'm going to wait for a trade on those. I'm not going to.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know,
like what I would really like to read is Weapon X. That's my top one, and actually both blue and gold. I wanted to read both of them just to see how they are, mm-hmm. see if one or the other really sticks with me. And I got to say, that Cable book sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Having James Robinson writing Cable, okay, he's got my attention. That's going to be something worth looking into, but. Yeah, we'll see how that all shakes out. Now, I don't have much to talk about on the indie side, because most of my Image books from this past couple weeks, like I said, they at the beginning, a lot of the books I've been reading hit their kind of middle chapters. Reborn hit issue 3, and while it was still good, it was definitely a middle chapter that felt more like, okay, here's a lot of expository stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be useful. Maybe it won't.
Yeah.
The artwork from Greg Capullo still looked great. Every bit of that was fantastic. And, I mean, he's the real draw for me. No pun intended. Actually, pun fully intended. I'll own that one. He's the real draw for me on this book.
Yeah.
But the other book, the other couple indie books I read were Moonshine number 3. Definitely a middle chapter, though. I liked some of the intensity of it, and there was still a really good, like, scary werewolf scene in there. And Brian Azzarello just knows how to write gangsters, so I'm totally invested in that book still. And then Descender started a new story arc, but the issue felt like it should have been the last chapter of the previous arc. Mm-hmm. But they've spent the last, three, four issues starting off in the present day, and then the rest of the issue is completely flashback to tell us the origins of certain characters. I'm like, that's fine if you want to do that in your story, but maybe you should dedicate an entire story arc to it and not bother with anything in the modern day. Like, just tell those stories outside of that context instead of giving us little snippets of the modern day stuff and, like, inching the story forward at a snail's pace. And then, you know, kicking off your next arc with what probably should have been the end of your previous one. Mm-hmm. So, it was still worth reading, though I felt it in the writing department was a little lackluster for Jeff Lemire. But at least the artwork was still up to the usual standard. But the real standout from Image to me for the past 2 weeks, actually it's been longer than 2 weeks, because it took me a little while to get caught up on this. My shop ran out of issue 2 of 7 to Eternity. But I finally got issues 2 and 3, read both of them right in a row, and yes, this book is like, I never knew that I could enjoy a fantasy comic so much, because usually I don't really dig that genre. But this has pulled me in. Rick Remender and Jerome Opeña, I believe is how you pronounce his name. I probably just butchered that. If I did, I'm sorry. But this book is just freaking amazing. Like, it's got a little Game of Thrones. It's got a little Lord of the Rings. And it mixes in a little bit of a sci-fi feel to it, which is kind of interesting to say because there's no real science to it. Everything is magic-based in this book, but it's just the aesthetics of it kind of have a sci-fi feel.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give... I want people to just go out and read this because the story is definitely kind of a revenge story, but not in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
And I do like in issue 2, they give you the explanation of the villain's powers and how it is that he could be the king or like the emperor of this giant land without having an army of his own. He's a king without an army, yet he rules absolutely. And at first, in the first issue, I was like, that doesn't really seem like it would work. That doesn't seem really plausible. And then you get to issue 2, and you get the full explanation of it, and okay, now I get how he did it. It wasn't that he had to build an army. He is able to get, if people invite him in, he promised, like, they invite him into their minds, into their souls. Because he promises to give them their heart's desires. And all it takes is for him to get inside one person. If he does that, he's with them forever. He's eternally linked to that individual that let him in. And he can hear and see everything that they hear and see. He knows everything they know. Like, all their deepest, darkest secrets, all the things that they witness and see, and he slowly builds that out over time, eventually getting to the point where he has blackmail material on all the most powerful people in the land, and he can see the desires that they have and know them before, even before they do, and hold that over their head or promise it to them And in a lot of ways, yes, he can deliver because he's in somebody else's head who can make it happen. So it's a really twisted, crazy kind of concept. But when you see it in full practice and you see how all the dominoes fell into place, it is a testament to the genius of Rick Remender as a writer. And he totally lets his RPG fanboy flag fly. He does it so hard in issue 3 because he has had this solo hero that he's been telling the story of, a guy named Adam, who was going to sacrifice himself to the Mud King, or the God of Whispers, as they call him. And he doesn't have a party, but he eventually does form one. I'm trying to find the exact quote, but anyway, the quote goes that he asked this one guy in the party if they even stood a chance of accomplishing this mission, and he's just like, "Well, there's like 7 of us, and our big tank is injured, and we have no healer. So,
yeah,
how do you think this is going to go?"
Yeah, I've lived that reference. I know exactly what he's talking about. It's so funny. That's cool.
And that's 7 to Eternity. That, and I gotta say, man, this is one of the most gorgeous books that I have ever read. The back, everything from the character designs to the backgrounds. The backgrounds really pulled me in. Just looking at this lush and just amazing world that Jerome has created. This just has to be seen to be believed. So if you can still find an issue of 7 to Eternity number 1, which I think it's gone to a second or a third printing now, so you should still be able to get them, get on that book. It is one of the most entertaining things that I've been reading for the last like couple months. And I'm so glad that I jumped on at the beginning, because it was one I had a feeling about just from the beautiful cover image. And that the interior art matched it. I was like, okay, now this is a book I want to keep reading. Between that and Reborn, I really am reading a lot more fantasy books than I ever thought I would.
There's definitely, like you said, there's a lot of good ones out there. You know, because I think, you know, like Reborn, has that same kind of flair to it.
It does. I would say Reborn even has a little bit, maybe a little more sci-fi to it than 7 to Eternity. 7 to Eternity is like pure fantasy. There's no link back to like our world at all. It is this is a different dimension altogether. So I highly recommend getting on 7 to Eternity. If people are going to do it now while it's still early. Because like I said, it's only 3 issues in. You should be able to get on it in time for issue 4 to come out. And if you are a fantasy RPG player, if you be it tabletop like D&D, or if you've you're a big Final Fantasy fan, or you played World of Warcraft, I think that this book will appeal to you. I think it will make you very, very happy. So that being said, that kind of brings us to the end of... Kelly, you had one indie book that you wanted to mention, so...
There's 2, but I mean, you know, all I can say about Josie and the Pussycats continues to be just a fun book, and that's all I'm going to say. I mean, it's fun, and I'm still enjoying it. IDW put out Optimus Prime number 1, which I didn't have on my list. I just pulled this off the shelf. And I really, really enjoyed it. I hadn't read a Transformer book in a while. It's been a while. But the art style is really good. It's kind of reminiscent of some of the stuff they did in the UK when they did the UK Transformer series. And I really don't want to spoil a whole lot in this issue, because I want people that are, you know, as always, like I was saying earlier, you know, people just, you know, if you got some extra cash, pick something up that you normally wouldn't, and try something new. I mean, just step outside your security zone or whatever you want to call it, and try something new. And I think you'd enjoy Optimus Prime. It's a good book. It's got lots of action. I mean, anybody pretty much knows who Optimus Prime is. And I think this book is pretty much kind of open to, you're not going to have to worry about a whole lot of backstory or back information. You kind of just get in there and go right along with it. So
that doesn't,
short and sweet.
Doesn't tie into the main Transformer series then, does it?
I don't know, because this is the first book that I've picked up. It had like a previously page, and it basically said, you know, Optimus Prime has annexed the Earth into the Cybertronian Council of Worlds. So wherever that took place, this might be kind of like the second chapter or the next part to that story arc. So,
in any case, if you're an Optimus Prime fan, it's probably something you can pick up on anyway and just and just run with it. And to your point, I think that's a good idea for people who, if you have some extra cash and you're like, I want to pick up a different book, something that, you know, is outside my pull list. Maybe you just dropped something and you were thinking of trying something out. I would suggest getting outside of Marvel and DC. Go try.
Definitely.
Go find you an Image book, something from IDW, Dark Horse, Boom Studios.
Yep.
Oni Press. All of these companies have some. Try out an Aftershock book. They've actually got some good stuff running right now, like American Monster from Brian Azzarello and Animosity from Marguerite Bennett. Those are a couple of books that I would absolutely recommend people check out. I think that they'd be pretty happy. If you're into gangster stuff, you know, American Monster is definitely probably for you. If you're into Talking Animals, kind of a fable-like story, but with a little bit of an edgy twist. Animosity has actually been a really big hit. That their first issue has already gone to 5 printings.
Wow.
Yeah, that's impressive for such a small company. It's definitely on my... that book has been on my radar for a while, and as soon as that first trade collection is out, I am definitely getting it. And it's the holiday season. You should be buying trades for all of your comic book geeky friends and family. I recommend Southern Bastards, as I actually gave Southern Bastards as a gift to people this holiday season, because it's that damn good of a book. But that kind of brings us to the end of the comics talk. So we got a little bit of TV stuff to go over. I don't think we're going to spend too much time here, because... it's been pretty well covered on another podcast, but Kelly, which of the 3 mid-season finales that we got since the last time we talked, which would be Flash, Arrow, and Legends, which one of those was your favorite?
I kind of think it's Legends of Tomorrow. I think is you know. My favorite out of all, tying down or winding down the, and I mean Flash was another good one, and Arrow. I mean I they're all good, but I think if I had to pick one, I think Legends of Tomorrow was my favorite.
It was another fantastic episode. I absolutely love the development of Heatwave. I think that they have done such a tremendous job with Mick. And the chemistry actually between Ray and Steel has been a pretty good bromance. I enjoyed their natural comedy. Like that's just fun stuff to me.
I agree. It's good, and I like to see that. The one thing that I've really enjoyed seeing is Sarah really take on the whole captain position, and really, you know, I didn't know if she could fill, you know, Rip's shoes, but she's done a damn good job. And in fact, I think she's, I would love to see Rip come back, of course, but even if they never did bring him back, I would have no problem with her continuing to be the, you know, the captain of the group. And well, and her interactions with Dr. Stein and the deal with his daughter really stood out to me. I really enjoyed that, you know, that little story arc.
That is another good point. I'm glad you brought up, because, man, that's all the stuff with Martin in the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
That has been so good. I really like that they've given him this kind of depth, and like we're seeing some real emotion out of him.
Yeah.
Which is something we didn't really get before, but
It's tough to do with an ensemble group sometimes. I mean, it you know.
It is. You're going to sacrifice spotlight to somebody. Like, somebody's going to take lead. That's just the way it goes. In any show, really. I mean, even Arrow has a big cast.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's still the Stephen Amell show.
Yeah.
He's still the lead, and what a performance he gave on the mid-season finale.
Yeah. I mean,
powerful.
That I think that was the most, you know, I enjoyed Legends of Tomorrow as my favorite, but I think the one that really made me have the feels was Arrow. Because like you said, that was this Prometheus, and you know, I was kind of skeptical about him as a villain. I was like, they really amped it up for this season. This is no Damian Dork. I mean, this guy is spot on. He is a villain. He knows how to hurt you. And yeah, I mean, the only other thing that really kind of it pissed me off and it kind of irritated me was the whole Artemis, you know, double cross. Yeah, you know, that blindsided me, and I was like, okay, so her whole thing is she just wants to see Ollie die. So she's been playing this whole time, you know. And I really wanted her to stand out as, you know, I wanted to see a new hero kind of emerge. You know, like the way I know you hate Scrap Dog or Junkyard Dog or was a Wild Dog.
Uh-huh.
And
actually, I like both of your names better. Scrap Dog is now a thing. Can we scrap him as a character? You know, that makes sense. He's a little bit of a scrappy do. Nobody likes him either.
Could we get rid of him and give more airtime to Ragman and Mr. Terrific? Give them some more.
I would take that. And, you know, maybe can we have an issue where Mr. Terrific doesn't get beaten within an inch of his life?
Yeah, yeah. And maybe.
Can we have that yet?
Can he finally, you know, understand, maybe I should, you know, I'm really tech savvy. Maybe I should come up with, instead of just, you know, because he's not a completely inept fighter. He needs more training, of course, but, you know, he really could use some help from tech. And he did that when he, you know, when they introduced him, he had his whole T-spheres and all that. And I mean, maybe they will do it. Maybe we'll see it eventually, but
yeah, well. We will hopefully get there. And, of course, I got to mention that Flash was another really great one. Loved the reveal about Savitar. Like that. At first, I was not feeling Savitar as a villain, but that mid-season finale, at least character-wise, made me like really like where they're going with that.
Yeah.
I'm back and forth on his look. Sometimes I think it's cool, and other times I'm like, this is a little to me. But that bit at the end, the whole Christmas theme, it just works for Flash. Like, Flash is a great Christmas character, and man, that last scene with Barry and Iris was just a feels fest for me. I loved every bit of that. But yeah, but Arrow was it for me as far as mid-season finales. That one had all the action, the hard-hitting emotional moments, and one hell of a performance from Stephen Amell. So, just fantastic show. I love everything they're doing right now. I hope that they can keep that momentum up.
Did they not have a mid-season finale for Supergirl?
They did, but it was the Invasion crossover episode.
Oh, that's cheap. That's so cheap. That was.
Yeah, things that make you say.
Really, really not digging that. But hey, okay, I can't have everything. You know, we can't have everything. You know, we had three really good, you know, mid-season finales. So
we did, and they felt like, you know, mid-season finales where Supergirl didn't. It just felt like another episode. Didn't really feel like a.
Yeah.
I guess it kind of did because they wrapped up a lot of stuff, but man, that's not where I would have put it.
I would have done something. But
yeah, I would have done like an actual mid-season finale and really built to that. But whatever. There, hopefully, the back half of Supergirl season will be better than how they wound up in this, like this first half, which has honestly been kind of hit and miss. But we'll see. But anyway, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will be joined by our special guest for our look back at the 2009 film Watchmen on our next episode of The Mist and the Maligned. Everybody, stay tuned, and we will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
There must be some kind of way out. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation Pop listeners. This is the Sellers Points Podcast, and you are about to be treated to another edition of The Missed and the Maligned. And in this edition of the show, we're going to be taking a look at that 2009 cult hit masterpiece, and hit is in quotation marks, Watchmen, directed by Zack Snyder. Of course, everyone's absolute favorite director in the whole entire world. And
who doesn't love Zack Snyder?
I don't know. And there he is. There's our guest that we were teasing you about in the first half. We didn't tell you who it was, but ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Sellers Points Podcast. Haven't seen him since episode 2. Mr. Keith Kalbeck from Comicosity.com and from the We Talk Comics Podcast. How you doing, sir?
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Man, it's always good to have a fellow Watchmen film fan on the show, because that is something that is kind of hard to find, honestly.
there are fans for this film, even from so early on with Zack Snyder, it is his divisive work for sure.
It absolutely is, and of course, while we've been on break, we've been in, welcoming you into the studio, as it were, to get acquainted here with Kelly, because you two have never talked before. So it's been interesting listening to you you two go on about your days working in the comic shop industry. Now, what we're going to get into with this movie is, of course, the idea that this was not a hit movie, not at all. And
I was surprised when you said the numbers, actually.
It's going to shock some folks, I think, because this movie was released in March of 2009. It was March 6, 2009, on a production budget of $130 million. That, given some of the superhero movies we've had, you know, since then, that doesn't sound like, you know, a ton of money to make a superhero film. But honestly, that's still pretty expensive, especially when you consider that it only made $107.5 million domestically in its entire run. And then its foreign take, its foreign box office, was only $77.7 million, bringing its total to $185.2 million.
And that's gross. That's
Yeah.
So figure the studio took a bath of you know, $50 to $70 million on this film.
Yeah, it's not what you would consider a huge hit. It's not even what you would consider a modest hit. This is a I've seen some call it a bomb, actually, and it's kind of surprising considering the popularity level of the original comic story from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, which is still celebrated today as being one of the pinnacles, if not the pinnacle, of the comics storytelling medium. And given what this story accomplished in comic book form, you know, maybe the bar was set against it from the outset, because, I mean, the graphic novel deconstructed the superhero in a time before that had actually, you know, happened. It was the story that did it, changed everybody's perspective. But I mean, for
you know, 25 years, this was considered an unfilmable graphic novel.
It was.
You know, there are, you know, four or a half dozen different scripts floating out there. I've read two or three different versions of it, and the guy who wrote Sam Hamm, who wrote the first draft of the Michael Keaton Batman, did a pass on it that was completely different than the comic. So yeah, this was generally considered something that could not be made. And then when the movie came out, I think a lot of people said, "See, we told you."
Yeah, I mean, and it's incredibly faithful to its source material.
How was the DVD sales? Because I know, like, I ended up seeing different types of editions come out, and I eventually bought, like, the ultimate cut of Watchmen, which was, and I could have sworn there were
There are three different cuts released.
Okay.
And then it's been repackaged in a whole bunch of bonus ones. Obviously, they're squeezing every dime they can out of the the DVD sales.
And it's the DVD sales were, I would think, probably decent enough that they kept Zack Snyder around, because, I mean, Warner Brothers does keep giving him work after all. It's not like they said, oh, well, this guy can't make a hit, and you know, passed on him. But when you look at the three versions, like I remember liking the theatrical version a lot, but when I saw the director's cut, I was like, nah, this version's superior. There's so much more of the emotional beats and like the little character stuff from the comic that was, you know, understandably left on the cutting room floor, because even the theatrical cut is about 2 hours and 45 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it's a long movie no matter what you do. And even though I recommend the director's cut, it's 3 hours and 6 minutes. You're going to be in this for a while.
You know, it's funny. I absolutely love this. It's one of my favorite comic book adaptations. I will fess up, though, that I did not like it in the theater.
Oh, really?
And it was specifically because it's strange. I'm not a big literal adaptation guy, and it was so close to the source material that I was kind of bored. And there was actually a point where I'm like, I'm watching it, and I'm like, okay, well, the half love scene between Laurie and Night Owl is coming up, so I can go to the washroom now. I know that there's no action going to happen for the next 2 minutes, because it's so incredibly close that I knew what the next three scenes would be.
Well, it was sort of action packed.
Let me tell you this.
No way.
But then the director's cut was a completely different experience coming back to it. And part of that was expectation and the different experience. But coming back, I had a completely different experience and really got into the art of the film.
And the one thing that I'm actually watching the movie right now just as a way to remind me of certain scenes that I wanted to touch on. They're getting to the opening credit sequence now, which I think is actually the crowning achievement of this movie. That is, and it's still one of the greatest things that Zack Snyder ever put together, giving you the history of all these characters. Like, he found a way to show us this history that was told in the in-between sections of the comic in Hollis Mason's Under the Hood book, which you actually get like those big excerpts from his tell-all biography. And they found a way to illustrate all of that stuff, or illustrate all this history and how these characters fit into all these like major moments in world history, and do it in such a grandiose and just beautiful way. Like, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this in a movie. And it's,
I agree. And the thing that I love about this movie is the way Zack filmed it, and the music that he chose for certain scenes. The one that stands out to me the most that I really enjoy is the scene where Nighthawk and Comedian are trying to disperse the crowd, and you know, the whole music playing, and it, I was like, that's amazing. I love that whole scene, and just the way it's kind of set up. And
yeah,
I think I agree with Keith that there were some things that I knew were coming up, and it was like, okay. I mean, once I rewatched it at home, I kind of got really into it, and it's one of those films that I've rewatched countless times. It's kind of one of my go-to films if I'm not feeling all that great, or if I'm kind of feeling down or whatever. I'll put this movie in, and it kind of perks me up. And kind of a funny thing about going to see it in a theater, a lot of folks didn't realize that this was a rated R film. This was not a superhero film, and I think certain folks came into it thinking, that didn't know anything about Watchmen, were surprised and kind of shocked, because when I went to see it with my friends, we're all sitting there in the theater, and I see this woman out of the corner of my eye walk down, and she's got two boys, probably 10 and 11, with her, and they come and sit down right in front of us, and I'll down, and I'm like, oh God, she doesn't know. And when the scene happens with Nighthawk and Laurie in you know the Artemis or the lovemaking scene, I see her take her hands and just put it over her son's just cover up their eyes during that scene, and I'm like, oh, she's going to be so mad.
It's amazing considering the graphic violence that this movie has had up to that point, and that was the thing that did it.
Yeah, yeah.
come on.
One of my friends was like, what are you laughing about when she walked down? I said, I'll tell you all later. This film's got so much stuff in it that's not meant for kids. She's got a rude awakening coming.
It's really not. And, I mean, the movie captured... So you're right. You guys are both right that it was such a literal translation of the book to screen that it left very little in the way of surprises. Like if you were familiar with the source material anyway, you knew exactly what was going to happen. And even when they made changes, you still got to the same point that the book got. I mean, the ending, the actual straight ending, is still the same.
Yeah.
Well, it's. I have a bit of inside information. I have a background in theater, and I worked in marketing on a show where the actor in the show was Jay Brazeau, who's a Canadian actor who plays Bernie, the news vendor,
nice.
In Watchmen. And I talked to him about Watchmen. I said, you know, I love this movie, and you know, what were your experiences? And his character has a much, much bigger part in the ultimate cut than he does in the director's, and far more than he's barely a cameo in the theatrical cut. And he said that the attention to detail for the source material was such that there was a giant stack of trade paperbacks on the set at all times. They would have blow-ups of the pages that they were working on that day. All of the set decoration folks were using blow-ups of panels to do all the decoration. And everyone on the set that wanted one walked away with a trade paperback. They just had pallet loads of these things because he was just obsessed with making this as close as he possibly could.
And I think that might have been to the idea that deviating would have gotten them so much blowback or gotten him like so much blowback that he probably wanted to make the movie, you know, that he thought fans really wanted to see, which was a almost literal translation. But when you get to that ending, the big climax, you kind of see why they changed a certain detail, like the whole giant squid thing. That wouldn't have played for audiences. I think that would have made the reaction like 10 times worse than it was. People would have been like, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
I mean, it works on the comic book page, but if you tried translating that to screen, you would have needed more real estate to tell that story, because the whole the artists and scientists and everything else that was required to make the creature, they had their own subplot. And, of course, that's removed from the movie. There's no way you could have fit it. You would have had a 3.5 to 4 hour epic on your hands, and this movie was already inflated.
It's funny. I have the change of the ending. I absolutely agree that you needed so many other story beats to pay that off, because otherwise it would just come out of nowhere. So you need the island, you need the writer, you need the artist. Like, you need all of these other story beats that just aren't important except to pay off that ending. And honestly, thematically, the ending of the film makes more sense than the ending of the comic, because it solidifies, you know, story-wise, it solidifies that Manhattan is out of the picture at the end of it. Because everyone believes that he attacked them, so he couldn't go back even if he wanted to.
I'm glad you made that point, because I was going to interject a very controversial opinion that I think the way they crafted that part of the story in the movie is superior to the comic. And
yeah,
That's just me. I know I can hear somebody groaning right now. I can feel the fanboy rage, and we haven't even like released this yet.
I think casting also in this film was spot on.
Yeah,
I think that there was not a character that the actor connected to that was not just kind of, I mean, that you're like, okay, I can see it. I understand it. Really, you know, Jackie Earle Haley didn't really know too much about him prior to this film. And then once I saw him on this, you know, and I was like, oh my God, he looks really reminiscent to the character in the comic.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he does.
Know,
when they took the mask off of him, he's got the red hair. It's like,
yeah, I mean,
it's like, dude, you are Rorschach.
And the costumes, you know, a lot of times there's always this, you know, and I hate to go reference this film because it's crap. And I'm sorry to anybody who likes the first or the X films in general, but you can't translate costumes so much like you were talking about, you know, to the big screen. Like you just can't. You have to kind of, but they took literally the costumes from the comic and they put them on the big screen and they made them look good. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just, you know,
I do like the X films, but you're right that, I mean, they basically chicken out on the X movies because they didn't think it would look right. And then, you know, Snyder takes those costumes and doesn't, they're not massively reinvented or anything to make them work on screen.
Maybe Night Owl 2's costume is a little different. It's a little more Batman-esque. But everybody else, and maybe Ozymandias' costume is a little different. And and I did like the nice touch. I like to think that this is a snub to Joel Schumacher that Ozymandias has nipples on his costume. I like to imagine that that's the case. It's probably not, but you know, that's just my you know, thinking behind it. But everybody's costumes, like their aesthetics, their color, the look, and
even the Archimedes was
Archimedes looked almost like it was straight off the comic book page.
I mean, they didn't take any liberties, and I understand you want to do that sometimes. You have, like in the X films. I mean, the X films aren't the worst films in the world. They've got their good.
You heard it here, folks. He finally said it.
Well, like I said, X2 is my favorite out of all of them. But you know, let's save that for another podcast. But you know, the thing that always got me was the costumes. Was just like, okay, so you got some black leather, and you got a little yellow, and you put an X on it. Good for you for not even attempting. You know, Magneto was the only one who had sort of a reminiscent to, you know, his costume as far as colors. And I know that you wouldn't want to put Ian McKellen in a Magneto costume from the 90s, you know. But
the big shoulder look was coming back.
Oh,
right?
God. Yeah. But I, like I said, I really think that, you know, the Watchmen just nailed it on so many points as far as doing a superhero film or an adaptation from a graphic novel. And
I will say
I don't think it gets enough credit, you know, in some aspects when it comes from the comic book community. I'm not talking about outsiders who may have seen it and liked it for what it is and didn't know anything else about it prior to going to seeing it. But from actual comic book fans, I think sometimes you might want to just take a second look at it.
I think that would be fair. I think people should give this this movie another look, especially the front half of this movie is some of the like just best storytelling that I've seen in a comic book adaptation. I just love that meeting between the two Night Owls when Hollis Mason and Dan Dreiberg are in the apartment, and Hollis is, you know, retelling him, you know, all those like stories from the old days. These two were just absolutely great together. I would love to see an extended version of that and just listen to Hollis Mason talk for a while, because I really like the guy that played him.
Yeah.
The only actor in this movie that I felt was a little overly smug and maybe hamming it up a little too much for his character's sake, was Matthew Good as Adrian Veidt or Ozymandias. He was pretty much the only one that I felt was, you know, he was telegraphing that he was going to wind up being the, like, quote-unquote villain, if you can even call anybody in this movie a clearly defined villain. Because in my mind, Rorschach and Adrian Veidt are two sides of the same coin. They're both basically villains by the end of the movie. And Dan Dreiberg and Silk Spectre 2 are pretty much the only heroes left. everybody else is either like Dr. Manhattan, like completely disconnected from any form of humanity, or everyone else other than him have like gone so far to one side or the other that, you know, you can't really call them heroic anymore.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they really tapped into the ambiguity of these characters that, you know, that Moore and Gibbons wanted from the story, that these, you know, the whole what would superheroes be like in our world, which is now incredibly cliche, but, you know, Watchmen was groundbreaking to really do that.
It was the first one to play with that idea of you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become a villain. And The thing is, I think that the reason this movie didn't have, it's a point I was alluding to earlier, was that maybe the reason this movie didn't have the impact that they were hoping for, that, or certainly not that the comic had, is that we had already had a movie tell us that in The Dark Knight the year before. And it had already basically deconstructed the superhero movie. I would say that The Dark Knight had deconstructed the superhero movie before Watchmen came along. And yeah, it's, you know, day late and a dollar short, buddy.
Do you think that if they had released, say, you think that they released the Watchmen movie like here in this time period rather than 2009, say maybe where we have a lot of these superhero films that have come out and they've been real successful, do you think that might, you know,
I don't know. Go ahead, Russell.
I don't think so, because I don't know how much truth there is to this. I just know what I see. And I'm seeing a real anti-Zack Snyder thing floating around out there among critics and some quote-unquote fans. It seems like anything he does, they automatically hate even before they really see it. So given that, I don't know that Watchmen would do better today. It may even do worse, but I think if you had released Watchmen, if they had been able to make this movie as it is and had released it, say, back in 2006, 2007, might have gotten a different response, might have been a bigger hit, because that would have been before we got The Dark Knight. It would have been before the first Iron Man movie. The MCU would not exist in any form. So it might have been a very different conversation about the film had it come out then. But that this was released, you know, in 2009, the MCU was a baby, but the Dark Knight trilogy had hit its apex with The Dark Knight. So kind of hard to say.
There is this almost, for movie audience, almost this Silver Age idea of what a superhero movie should be. Like free of consequences, free of, I don't want to say darkness, but any kind of like serious bent, like, you know, to actually try to say something. I mean, I don't want to do a Marvel versus DC, because I think that there's lots, like the DC TV stuff does it for me sometimes too. You know, Man of Steel, we're now like 3.5 years since the movie came out, and not a day goes by someone doesn't complain about the ending of Man of Steel. Supergirl, like 3 weeks, Supergirl 3 weeks ago killed a villain in a big fight. And she like, and then instead of like, you know, anguish or consequence, she goes, "Eh, what can you do?" And there's no reference to it again. And people are fine with it. That's like, people will still point at Supergirl as that's, you know, that's the way superhero movies should be.
Yeah,
it should, like, it all should be like that, with, you know, fancy bright costumes and free of consequence.
And that is a problem that I've definitely had with people who are praising Supergirl but dumping all over Man of Steel. And it's even funnier to me that the first season of Supergirl, the plot from episode one all the way to the conclusion of it, was Man of Steel. It was Man of Steel's plot. Kryptonian invasion, trying to terraform Earth into being a new Krypton. Yep. Same plot, complete with a moment of her adoptive father telling her that maybe she should let people die instead of saving them if there's a chance that she might get caught.
Yeah, I mean, her sister says that in the very first episode.
Father says it to her, too.
We're tangenting. But yeah, and another challenge that Watchmen has is that the story was brand new when it came out. That idea of deconstructing superheroes was new. And now we've had 30 years of it. It's, you know, coming back to it. It's like you've what I watched Airplane, the parody movie Airplane, you know, 100 times when I was a kid. I had never seen Airport, the movie it was parodying. So 20 years after seeing Airplane, I finally watched Airport 77, the movie that it's primarily parodying, and it was really kind of surreal watching it, because I'm watching the not punchline having seen the punchline so many times. And and the Watchmen film is a bit of that, of you've already seen all of the riffs on Watchmen. Now here's the movie that you probably should have seen 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's like if they'd made this movie, if they'd been able to film Watchmen right after the comic story concluded, you know, kind of like how we do in today's world, maybe the movie could have been a hit. I mean, who knows? I mean, that's impossible to say. But yeah, you are absolutely right that we've spent the last 30 years seeing every comic book company from like DC, Marvel, even Image gets in on the act, deconstructing the superhero. And it's like, all right, Watchmen did it first, did it best, and then everybody else has just been riffing on it.
Yeah, I mean, basically everything Mark Miller's ever written is
all snap.
Is that?
Whoops! Not to tell tales out of skew.
But that's what I mean. It's like, you know, you've got folks like Morrison to a lesser extent, but Warren Ellis for certain. Warren Ellis, Mark Miller, who have made their bread and butter in this deconstructing of superheroes.
I think a prime example of that would be Mark Millar's Ultimates. And for Grant Morrison, it would be anything he's ever written.
And yeah, and
with the exception of maybe All-Star Superman.
I mean, and Ultimates being such a huge influence on the MCU.
Very much so.
So that whole superheroes in our world thing is so incredibly ingrained in superheroes now. But it wasn't in the Bronze Age was not that at all.
No. And another thing about the Watchmen comic that, you know, I've heard some complaints about this, about the movie, is that in the comic, you know, it takes place in 1985. That's the year that the book actually came out. So it feels like, you know, it's a modern world. Yeah. And they tried to recreate the feel of that in the film. And one of the criticisms I've seen, and maybe there is a little bit of legitimacy to this, they say that it doesn't really feel like the 1980s. It doesn't necessarily feel like, you know, it's 1985. And we're living in, you know, 1985 New York. I do feel like maybe Zack Snyder tried to make up for that a little bit with the use of music, because there are several little 80s tunes, or like popular 80s tunes, scattered throughout. And every once in a while, you'll see the backdrop, the old New York skyline, of course, with the Twin Towers still standing. And funnily enough, airship, like blimps flying around the city.
Yeah.
Which is a nice touch.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other challenge of this, is it's not just 1985. It's an alternate 1985 that hasn't that where, you know, our world diverged from its in like this in when's Manhattan supposed to change?
Late 60s?
Mid to late 60s, something like that?
It was 59, actually, I think.
Is it?
Yeah, it's like early 60s, because he gets involved in Vietnam and wins the war for America. And that's really where the deviation in history happens.
So not only is it 1985, you know, and you're, you know, it's 30 years after... after that, so you know, the bulk of your audience wasn't even born, but you've had a divergence of history from even 20 years before that. So, so you do have you have electric cars, you have dirigibles, you have different technology. So yeah, it's asking a lot of the audience to buy into that world.
And do you think that maybe thinking back to the advertising for this movie, I remember the first just epic trailer they put out for it, using the Smashing Pumpkins song, "The End Is Begin," or "The Beginning Is the End Is the Beginning," which, funnily enough, was originally on the Batman and Robin soundtrack. but it was such a well-cut trailer, but it did make the movie look like a standard superhero flick. It focused, you know, heavy on the action, like the quick cuts, and Zack Snyder's a master of that. That guy just knows how to cut a trailer. And that was how Watchmen appeared. And do you think that maybe one of the reasons that people didn't go see this is because of word of mouth spread that this movie is super long and it's not really that much of an action movie? But could that have had something to do with it?
I mean, it's always hard to armchair quarterback this stuff, but certainly, I mean, any movie, now we're a bit more used to it because of the Lord of the Rings movies, but you go over 2.5 hours and it's starting to feel like a real commitment. It's also hard for movie theaters because they can't play as many screenings a day. That's like the real that's the dollars and cents of why movies are generally the length they are, is that movie theaters want to be able to get an extra screening. So they don't put it on as many screens. Zack Snyder's movies, contrary to his detractors, they ask a lot of the audience. He's an incredibly visual storyteller, and he doesn't hand you stuff. Go ahead.
Sucker Punch.
Oh, God, yeah. I absolutely adore Sucker Punch. You were talking about how you put on Watchmen when you're down. Sucker Punch is the movie I put on.
Yeah, that's
beautiful.
The film is beautiful. And a lot of people have watched it and go, I don't know what I just watched. I don't know the story. Mm-hmm. And I had to go, I don't completely know either. But it's fun to watch and try to kind of pull things out of it that maybe you missed or maybe you didn't. You know, it's a thinking movie to me when I watch it. And you know, it's not just about these pretty girls and these situations. There's all this other stuff kind of going on. And like you said, Zack Snyder doesn't hand you. He doesn't coddle you. He doesn't walk you through it. He's just like, here you go. Have fun. I'm out.
His movies are more challenging than they would get credit for. I do have to, like, if there was one criticism that I would have of Zack Snyder is that at times he can get a little heavy-handed. There's imagery that he likes to use that I think is a little too on the nose. Like Man of Steel is probably has the most egregious example of it for me, even though I still hold that up as my absolute favorite Superman movie. The scene in the church when he's talking to the priest. And you see the stained glass window of Jesus praying in the garden before he's about to sacrifice himself, like right over Clark's shoulder. I was like, that's a little on the nose there, Zach. Like you hammer the hell out of it with that one. And of course, we still get Superman in a Jesus Christ pose later in the movie. So I was like, you know, you don't have to keep hammering it, Zach. I think we get it. He didn't do it quite so heavy in Batman v Superman, though. Like he seemed to pull back a little, but there are as far as like heavy-handedness in this movie and Watchmen, it was more in the violence that I felt like it went further than it needed to. Because there's a scene even when Dr. Manhattan like explodes a bunch of gangsters in a bar, and their skeletons and entrails and everything else are stuck to the ceiling and dripping on people. I was like, that's not in the book.
I think again... pushing that superheroes in our world thing, like the people you don't punch someone once and they fall unconscious and stay unconscious, that always kills me on Arrow. Is you punch one guy and then you move on to the next guy because the other guy's unconscious and he'll remain unconscious, I guess, forever. I don't know how that's supposed to work, one of my favorite scenes in Watchmen is the jailbreak scene.
I absolutely love that.
Yes, it is, but it is so viscerally violent.
That one, to me, like hit all the right beats, like the level of violence that this movie like should have reached as its peak. Like that should have probably been the most violent scene of the movie. But the scene in the alleyway with
the alleyway scene.
That's over the top. And like the scene that still bothers me a little bit because I've never known Silk Spectre to be a killer in any way, but she straight up stabs a dude in the neck. He did.
They were breaking bones too, and I was like,
yeah, that
this is almost like, you know, they don't have superpowers, but I mean, you have to have a lot of strength to, you know, break bones. And
yeah, I could see her like breaking some dude's arm and like it not breaking through the skin and blood going everywhere, but one shot. And she's like, boom, I'm practically ripping this dude's arm off. And I was like,
these guys all have Mr. Glass syndrome.
Exactly. It's just like, we've gone from Watchmen to Unbreakable. Shouts to M. Night.
Well, I mean, you know, there were so many bones breaking and they show the bones pop out. And one of my friends was watching it with me. And he actually broke his arm real bad where the bone stuck out. And he was telling me just how traumatic that was. And when he saw that scene, he literally just got up and said, all right, I'm done. I can't watch any more of this scene. Tell me when it's done. You know.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it was so over the top with that level of violence for two characters who don't have superpowers. Like, now, there is a violent scene later with Rorschach that I was like, okay, well, you can justify this level of violence to get across the point that he has fully snapped, that there is nothing left of his humanity left. The scene when he has the pedophile there that's killed the little girl and fed her to the dogs, and he like chops the dude's face off with a cleaver, and that was really tough to watch in the theater. It's tough to watch anytime, but at least then I was like, you know, this feels like a level of violence that you needed to show. This feels like something that, you know, truly furthers the character and gives you the full background as to why he is the way he is. But to your point, Keith, that prison break scene is one of the best action scenes, I think, that Snyder's ever shot. Just brutal, but tremendously fun.
Yeah.
And this movie will sneak up on you too. It's got some nice comedy in it. I was glad that they kept the whole porno comic, the Silk Spectre porno comic thing in the plot, and they actually show you pages from it to the point where it's like, man, y'all got away with that in an R-rated movie. That's like some triple X stuff. Seriously, it was funny. Yeah. And it was also kind of funny to me that the lady playing Silk Spectre 1, Sally Jupiter, who was Carla Gugino, I think is how you say her last name.
Gugino?
Yeah, something like that. I find her more attractive than Malin Ackerman. I'm sorry, she's hotter. But one thing I do...
That's just objective fact. That's okay.
It's objective. it's true. Though. But... one thing I did like about this movie, that I think another thing that it got better over the comic, was Laurie Jupiter is almost completely unlikable in the comic. Like, to the point where you're like, just straight up hate her because of the way she's written. But then the movie comes along, and she's... I think it's a lot to do with Malin Ackerman's performance, because I sympathized with this character. I found her to be much more sympathetic, to be someone that I actually wanted to see more of, that I didn't just like straight despise her when she was on screen. And by the end of the movie, I'm like, I genuinely like her. But this is pretty amazing thing that Zack Snyder has done.
Yeah, I mean, Alan Moore's not known for his compelling and in-depth portrayals of women.
He really isn't.
They really do grow, without adding a huge amount of story beats, they really grow out Sally and Lori in motivation significantly in it.
And I was having a conversation with a friend the other night, because I always look at this one scene that I guess people would call quote-unquote problematic in the comic and in the movie, is the attempted rape of Sally Jupiter by the comedian. And it's a really brutal scene. But given some of the stuff that you learn about these characters in like Before Watchmen, and then even some of the stuff that happens later in this movie and later in the comic, I had this little fan theory that maybe this was the game they played. Like, this was their thing. And that Hooded Justice walked in at the wrong time. Maybe close the door next time, Eddie.
Let me tell you this. When I first read this, and this was the early 80s, and I was getting this book off the rack at the place here in town where they sold comics, this little coin shop, basically. He also, sold comics. I remember reading that and feeling, because I was in my early teens. It was really one of those, moments where you read something like, God, what? That's made me feel really just kind of ugh, as far as. But the whole series itself was, I have to admit that I didn't get it when I first read the complete 12 issues. There were a lot of things I didn't understand that I had to come back later and reread where I was getting all of this new kind of knowledge from the series, like, and that's the other thing too, is like, for me, it was just my age. I think I just didn't, I wasn't old enough to really understand or appreciate some of the story plots and things that was going on,
And I felt that same way too. Like, every time I see it now, it's still one of the most uncomfortable scenes in comics or in film. Like, anytime I see it, I'm still like, I don't feel like I'm being entertained. I feel like I'm disgusted, because it's tough to watch. Even though the rape doesn't actually happen, it's still like, it's a brutal assault. And it's one that, stuck with me after. And it's one that I, trying to consider all the story beats that come after it, trying to put it all into a level of context that says that maybe Sally Jupiter was a little messed up herself. Like, it's kind of hard to tell. It's like, did this mess her up, or was she messed up before?
Yeah, I think that's one of the themes through the whole story, is people are complicated and life is complicated. And sometimes it's messy and sometimes it doesn't make any sense.
And that's almost exactly what Sally Jupiter says to her daughter, is that it's messy and complicated, and sometimes things just don't make sense. And that's, you could say that about this the Vietnam scene too, which was far more brutal in the movie than it was in the comic. But man, to call back to the casting, Jeffrey Dean Morgan as the comedian. We mentioned Rorschach before, but I gotta say, this guy deserves all the credit in the world. He was playing Negan all the way back in Watchmen, folks. It's like, you think he's over the top and brutal and that? Y'all need to go back and watch Watchmen. This dude was auditioning for the role back then, before it even existed.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, Negan will just talk you to death. I mean, the comedian's actually dangerous.
Yeah, it's like the comedian burns people alive, shoots folks, and just takes, you know, pure joy in doing it. I mean, what a performance.
Well, and it's interesting. You mentioned the scene in Vietnam with Dr. Manhattan, and that is quite quick in the comic. I mean, it still serves the same beat, but by playing it up in the film, it really tells you so much more about the comedian as a character and tells you so much about Dr. Manhattan. And because there is that there's that accusation of, you could have stopped me. You could have done 100 things, and you just let it happen because you don't really care. Ultimately, when chips are down, you do not care about people. And so you've, like, both of them are so clearly informed by that scene. It tells you so much about them in a very short length of time.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is during this scene, I'm watching it right now with a comedian shooting this woman that he had gotten pregnant. Dr. Manhattan, you know, is telling him to stop. He's telling it very calmly at first, but then he yells at him to stop. But that's a departure from the comic, where Dr. Manhattan tells him to stop, but he never shows any emotion whatsoever. He never raises his voice. So it's a departure there, which I always found a little odd.
Well, and I think maybe it's to mirror the later scene in the TV studio where the same kind of moment happens.
He gets
overwhelmed. He sees everything that's happening, but he's still surprised, which is an interesting place for a character to be. That, how do you portray that they know everything that's going to happen, including that they're going to be surprised.
And that's and they do that again on Mars. It's a thing that constantly happens with Dr. Manhattan. It's like you're never quite sure where his head's at. And man, speaks to the genius of Alan Moore, really, to be able to write a character in such a fourth dimensional way.
There's other small things too, like when him and Laurie teleport to Mars and he forgets to, hey, she can't breathe here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's not, you just really see that disconnection more and more, that he's not paying attention to humanity and the whole, you know, part of what he used to be human is just kind of alien to him.
And I did like the progression of his character. Like, I mean, they do it in the comic and they also do it in the film. And I hated this about how people took it in the movie, because we all know that John walks around naked pretty much for the duration of the film. So you've got a big blue CGI penis, like, flopping back and forth every once in a while. And people, when I saw it in the theater, people were snickering. They couldn't help but laugh. And I'm like, I hate that it's this way, but, you know, that's kind of a visual representation of where his character's at. He sees very little use in even trying to pretend to be human anymore. Even though he may still be somewhat shaped like a human being, at that point, it kind of seems like he doesn't view himself that way. Maybe he doesn't view himself as a god just yet, but he's not far from it.
Yeah.
But that's maybe, and you know, the sex scene, of course, between Night Owl and Silk Spectre was another one that was unintentionally hilarious.
Well, for me, it was watching that woman cover up her son's, you know.
Well, that was intentional hilarity. I'm pretty sure she did that for your benefit, Kelly, or at least that's how I will remember it from now
on. You
know
what? I kept watching her sometimes more than I was watching the film, because I kind of knew what was going on, but I would just keep looking at her reaction and what her, you know. And I definitely got a few chuckles out of it. Yeah.
And speaking of the one of your favorite scenes, Kelly, the riot scene, which uses Casey and the Sunshine Band's Boogeyman.
Yeah. I love that whole scene. I just got jazzed when I saw that. I was like, oh, the scene is just so awesome.
It's
and just the desperation in Nidal's voice when he's like, you know, talking to comedian, and he's just, I don't give a shit. I'm just, you know.
Yeah. The line that strikes me in that, it struck me in the book, it strikes me in the movie even harder, is whatever happened to the American dream?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Comedian says, it came true. You're looking at it. I'm like, you know what? That is actually horrifyingly true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe that to me, it's like we were saying before, Zack Snyder wants you to think whenever you're watching his movies. Maybe he does the slow-mo thing and does a lot of the, has a few of the Michael Bay isms, but you know what? Michael Bay wishes he could make a movie like Zack Snyder. He straight up wishes he could direct a movie this well. Because you look at the...
I wish you hadn't mentioned his name.
Well, people compare the two all the time. I see it all the time, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. Michael Bay couldn't direct his way out of a paper bag unless it was, like, exploding.
I saw the previews for the next Transformer film, and I just...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I went to go see Rogue One, and that was part of it.
Yeah, that it didn't fill me with any form of hope for that franchise, which I haven't had since the second movie. So I look at Zack Snyder, and maybe he does use slow-mo. Maybe he does, like, some crazy explosions every once in a while. But come on, this guy knows how to tell a visual story and do it incredibly well. And Watchmen is a testament to that. And as much as I enjoy Man of Steel, I really do think this might be Zack Snyder's best movie. It feels like his most complete picture. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think? Do you think this is the best example of Zack Snyder's work?
That's a tough one. I might have to stay with Sucker Punch on that one.
Oh yeah.
I think purely because Sucker Punch is his only movie that's really his.
Yeah.
Everything else is drawing from, it's either, you know, adaptations or drawing from other materials. Sucker Punch is the only one that's like purely him telling his own story. Everything, 300 and Watchmen are essentially, you know, taking the comic as the storyboards.
And he did the remake of Dawn of the Dead, which was a breakthrough hit for him when he worked with James Gunn. Surprisingly, James Gunn was the writer on that movie.
I just forget that, yeah.
And speaking of writers on movies, Zach did direct this, but the guy who wrote the screenplay for this movie is very interesting. His name is David Hayter. He was the voice of Solid Snake in the Metal Gear Solid series. He was also the voice of King Shark on The Flash.
He didn't have a whole lot of, voice time, I think.
And if you guys want a real deep cut for David Hayter, go look up Guyver 2 Dark Hero. He plays the lead.
And he was actually one of the writer or one of the writers on the original X-Men movie.
Yes.
Which is interesting. And Scorpion King. So, you know.
So take that for what you will.
There's a blast from the past.
I think the special effects of that one consign it to the bin, unfortunately. As we were getting set here, I just clicked on a bunch of links to have open while we were talking, and I found Roger Ebert's review of Watchmen, which is fascinating to read because there's only one reference to Zack Snyder's name, and you look at reviews now, it's all about the personalities involved, and his review doesn't have anything like that. It is purely about the film as a piece of film. And he gave it 4 stars.
Roger Ebert used to be my go-to guy for film review when he was alive. Yeah, he was my go-to guy.
Yeah. It's a very thoughtful review. Encourage listeners to pull it up, but I just want to read the first couple of sentences here. After the revelation of The Dark Knight, here is Watchmen, another bold exercise in the liberation of the superhero movie. It's a compelling, visceral film. Sound, images, and characters combine into a decidedly odd visual experience that evokes the feel of a graphic novel.
And he's absolutely right, which is seems like from what you said about your friend who worked on the who was in the movie, that's exactly what Zack Snyder was going for.
And he calls it the dilemma of functioning in a world losing hope.
And that is spot on. And it kind of feels like that's the track that Zack Snyder was on from this movie into Man of Steel and then into Batman v Superman. And now maybe he's on the pendulum swing back the other way. Because, as I've said to other people, that I felt like his version of the DC Universe was creating a world that felt like it needed superheroes. A dark, twisted, almost like, you know, not necessarily hopeless, but people looking for hope.
Mm-hmm.
People who know they need it. People who are looking for something or someone to believe in. And when someone like that comes along, not just, you know, immediately instilling that or installing that person as the beacon of hope, but challenging them to become it, to rise to the occasion. And when we get to, hopefully when we get to Justice League, we will see the fruits of those labors. We will see, you know, a Superman, a Batman, and a Wonder Woman who have risen to that occasion. I mean, it's still going to be a different world. It's still not going to be the Richard Donner world that some people seem to be just trapped in. it's never going to be that. And I think anybody hoping for that is just kidding themselves. But I do think that where he's headed, at least in terms of the films that he's made from Watchmen all the way up to Batman v Superman, seems like he was doing his own take on the deconstruction of the superhero world, only to maybe put it back together again in a way that hopefully will modernize it and allow people to see that, yes, there is still hope out there. There is still, you know, that hope and quote-unquote joy, which is a word I hate seeing in reviews.
it's one of the it doesn't even come close to the word fun for me in just meaningless words to put in because it's a completely personal view.
And you know that the word joyless would be used in the review of Watchmen in modern day.
Of course,
they would call this movie joyless. And that's
ridiculous. I mean, I'm trying to think of something that brings me more joy than Man of Steel, but I've been arguing for a while that what Snyder's doing is, you know, everyone talks about it as continuing deconstruction of superheroes. I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's reconstruction, and I think Watchmen is. I think he's starting from the point where they are deconstructed. He's not doing that. He is starting from, you have already seen Batman taken apart into its component parts. You have seen superheroes taken apart in Watchmen. Now we have to build it back up into the inspirational thing. We have to bring that back together in the same way that the DC Rebirth special is a lot like that. It's starting from, this is a dark and cynical world. Now we have to move forward into a new light, not backward into some silver bronze age thing that we can't recapture.
Exactly. Yes, hope still exists. Yes, all those things can be in the world, but the world has changed and we do have to change with it, but it doesn't mean that you can't find happiness or that happiness can't exist. And I like the point you made there, and it kind of speaks to why having an older Batman in that universe makes more sense, because you just had a Batman trilogy where we told his beginnings all the way up to him being aged. And to just go back and retell that story over again, you know, so especially so soon, wouldn't really fit, you know, with the idea of reconstructing the superhero. Because you start at that point with Superman, sure, but with Batman, you might as well go forward and show that no matter how far gone you may think he is, you can come back. It's like you can come back to be that hero that people you know and love and you know feel hopeful about. And from what I've seen, it looks like we're on the road to that. It looks like that slow build to that really great superhero epic. And not to knock the way that Marvel and Disney have been doing their films. They work fine. That's their method, but that's not the world that the DC universe, or at least the DCEU, exists in. So people expecting a Marvel movie when they go to see a DC picture, you know, it kind of sucks that Marvel did run out the gate so successfully right to begin with, to the point where people think of a superhero movie and that's what they picture, and it seems like they're not open to anything else. And I think that that's another reason that that a movie like Watchmen struggles with folks, because this is not the typical superhero film, and in today's world it may be even more hated than it was back in 2009, just because of movies like, I hate to say it, even though I love these movies, the Iron Man films and the Captain America movies, they're not this. they are not this. They will never be this. And for the audiences that gravitate to that and think of that as their superhero movies, or people that look at Guardians of the Galaxy and say, that's my superhero movie, that's my favorite, absolutely love it, they may have a hard time adapting to something like this that is so visceral and in your face. So that's just my two cents on why this movie doesn't capture the audience like it maybe had or should have. Now, we're coming close to the end of the podcast here, and we've had a great time talking about this movie and talking about some of the finer points of it and what works, what doesn't. I want to get both of you guys' final thoughts on Watchmen, the film, before we wrap, and which version of the film should people watch if they've never experienced it before. And Keith, as our guest, I'd like to start with you.
All right. I will go with the director's cut. I think it's it really fleshes out the character points without overburdening. I think the ultimate cut goes a bit too far in side journeys. I would actually recommend the director's cut and then separately the Under the Hood DVD if you can track it down. There's an extra DVD that has Under the Hood, which is a fake documentary, and an animated version of Tales of the Black Freighter, which are mostly incorporated in the ultimate cut, but as part of the story. I think they work better as a separate piece. And I heard an interview with Dave Gibbons a couple of years ago, he said the director's cut is his preferred cut as well. So if I can bring in Dave Gibbons' vote. Yeah. For what that's worth.
At least he participated in the film to an extent.
Quite a bit, actually. A bit.
He was, as most people know, I don't know if most people know this, but Alan Moore is kind of a recluse and never got on board with the idea of any of his comic work being made into film. So this one being one of those that I think he spoke heavily against for a number of years.
He was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen kind of burned him on that. Gibbons was very involved, you can find it fairly cheaply. I picked it up for really $15 or something. The Art of the Film, Watchmen, The Art of the Film. Most of Snyder's films have a hardcover behind-the-scenes book called The Art of the Film. They're exceptionally well done, and the Watchmen one is no exception. And included in that are, again, talking about how Snyder's attention to detail, he, having rewritten the ending of the story, he and Gibbons collaborated on 3 pages of new Watchmen comic art, where Gibbons told the ending of the movie before they filmed it. so that Snyder could then use that as his reference to do the ending of the movie. And those pages are included. So it's basically three new pages of Watchmen story that do appear nowhere else besides this this hardcover.
That makes it worth tracking down all by itself.
Character designs by David Finch and Adam Hughes, amongst others, that that worked on early costume designs.
And wow, that see, this is stuff I didn't know. I'm going to have to go out and find some of this stuff myself, because that sounds like something I need to read. Kelly, which version of the film do you think people should start with?
Excuse me. I think the director's cut also. Now, I personally like the ultimate cut. That's the one that I like, but I think what would be better for, you know, an outside audience, I think the director's cut would be a better version to watch. The ultimate cut's just my preference, but I think the director's cut is if that's all you watch, if that's, you know, the version you see, then you know you're picking the best one. And it's this, you know, to me, just one of the best comic book films, you know, that I've you know, when I talk about it with friends and stuff, when we're talking about films, you know, Watchmen, I bring Watchmen up, you know, all the time, because it's one, like I said, that doesn't get enough credit. And I've got friends that you know, they don't really like it too much, and it's interesting to hear their thoughts on it. But I, you know, I think that overall, I think the film really, it did a really good service to the source material. And I think visually and just the way it was done, I don't think there's any other way you really could have done it. I think that pretty much nailed it.
I'm going to make it 3 for 3 and say the director's cut is absolutely the way to go. It's my preferred version of the film, even though I have seen the ultimate cut once. And I did like the documentary side, the Under the Hood documentary being added into the film. And I do like Tale of the Black Freighter better whenever it's incorporated into the movie rather than watching it separately, because I feel like, just like in the comic, Tale of the Black Freighter is meant to be a parallel to what's happening in the main story. So watching it separately, I wasn't a big fan of it, but seeing it incorporated into the movie like in the ultimate cut, I liked it more that way. So I feel like if you're going to see the whole, like the complete experience, and you've got, say, 4 hours to kill, yeah, totally go for the ultimate cut. Yeah, that's going to be some time well spent. You know, rainy afternoon, good. That's a good idea. But the director's cut is really a good way to go. It'll give you the full. I feel like it gives you the full experience, the full story, and certainly hits all the major character beats and gives you all that, just like all the grandiose and like just amazingly shot stuff that Snyder did, even though he did direct all of the, I believe he directed that that documentary, and I know he directed the Tale of the Black Freighter animated movie. But this, as an exercise, as a film, I think that we've established that all three of us are big fans of this movie, that we feel that it's underrated. It's unfortunate that it doesn't get the love that it deserves. But, you know, maybe us talking about it in such a positive light will get people to go and, you know, give it another shot. Give Watchmen a look through a different set of eyes, and to, you know, see it, at least attempt to see it the way that we do. It's just been a... it's been fun to reminisce about that movie and to, you know, close out our 2016 podcast with, you know, such a high point. And Keith, it's fun to have you back, man, because we kind of started this thing with you, and we're going to close out 2016 with you. So thank you for coming back onto the show. It's been fun having you back in.
Thanks. Well, thanks for inviting me, and I love being part of talking about the love of this film and an enjoyment of what Zack Snyder brings to movies. I think even if you don't like him, spend a bit less time thinking about him then. because for those of us who enjoy his work, there's just so much to dig into that I'd rather spend my time doing that than listening to your yap.
One thing I did want to touch on before we go is we know there's been a whole series of like Before Watchmen comics that came out a couple years ago. And one of them by the late, great Darwin Cook called Minutemen. I hold up as a piece of storytelling that's very worthy of being included in the Watchmen lore. Maybe not all of those stories were that great or added much to the overall narrative, but I felt like that one really did. And if there were ever to be a... Do you guys think that a prequel movie to this could be made out of that? Do you think that that would be something that you would even want to see? Or maybe a TV show?
It's hard to say. I did enjoy some of the prequel Watchmen series, like Minutemen. I did enjoy that more than some of the others. But it's a lot of material to kind of maybe animated. Maybe if they did an animated version, that might.
I would watch that.
It's like I said, it's kind of hard to say, and at least in my opinion, if it would work.
And Keith,
I enjoyed the Before Watchmen stories as comic work. I think it's interesting that you used a phrase similar, needed to be told, something like that. And Minutemen's the one that I felt needed to be told. The others have what I call prequelitis.
Yeah.
There's an old adage, you should always start a story as late as you can. Prequels are by definition not that. Because the story didn't need these stories to work. Minutemen is the one part that really isn't dealt with in depth in the original Watchmen. Because really the Minutemen exist to give you a sense that the world has happened, not here are some adventures of them. It's really creating a backstory to that world and filling that part out. And so to see those characters actually fight crime and work together and have complex lives, be developed characters as opposed to, what Moore gave us, which is, yeah, we're pretty sure that guy was, he liked being tied up, and this character was gay. But it's really kind of like, there's really only a couple of bullet points that develop them as characters. Minutemen actually does show you them as characters. And probably Silk Spectre is the one that adds the most, because you do again, like, she's not a, Laurie is not a well-developed character in the original Watchmen comics, and by giving her own adventure, it develops that character a bit more.
Also by Darwin Cook.
Yeah, so I think, those are definitely the ones that had the most to add to it. I will say that Rorschach, I've been with my wife for over a decade, 12 years now, and Rorschach is the only comic book I've ever gotten her to read, because she absolutely loves that character in the Watchmen movie, and I showed her the Lee Bermejo art, and she read all those issues, and she's not read a single thing since. But I got her to read a comic book because it was Rorschach.
Not sure what that says about that comic.
Well, I think it's that it did do one of the things, which is that it actually brought in people who were fans of the film. And could use that as an entry point.
And it's hard to resist Lee Bermejo art. That guy is supremely talented. And that book did look good. It just one of those that I didn't feel like it added a whole lot to the proceedings. But anyway, that has been our look back at the 2009 Zack Snyder directed Watchmen film. We hope that you guys have enjoyed listening to us go on and on about that, and of course about our apparent fanboy love of all things Zack Snyder, because we had no idea that it was going to come to that, but we did it anyway because, well, we can't help ourselves. And that also wraps up Seller's Points for 2016. It's been a fun ride this year. I mean, I started off as a solo act trying to bring in as many guests as I could, and then I was lucky enough to add Kelly as my regular co-host. So that's the thing that I am most thankful for this year in 2016 is that Kelly was willing to do this with me.
I'm glad I've got to be a part of it.
It has been a crazy ride so far, and we're not done. I will be making one more appearance on the Place to Be Nation podcast with the Hard Traveling Fanboys End of Year podcast, which you guys will be looking out for pretty soon. And speaking to those guys, this podcast about Watchmen actually did kind of have a little symmetry with them because they just recently did what they called the I can't do the sound effect, but it's the largest podcast ever, where they took a look at a fan film called Watchmen Rorschach. And if you have not experienced that, go do that now. Find that.
I've heard of that.
Yes. When you see this, when you experience, Keith, I don't know if you've experienced it yet, but it has to.
No, I've not.
It has to be seen. You have to watch this, and you will see a bald, lanky, sometimes redneck Rorschach with a Dr. Manhattan that can only be described in as erect nipples. That's all I can say. That's all I'm giving you. You just have to go experience this for yourself and be prepared to laugh. But that is on the PlaceToBeNation.com website right now. Look up some Hard Traveling Fanboys, you and listen to their podcast and all the other great podcasts we have on Place to Be Nation Pop. Glenn Butler, Our Spectacular. We've got Geek and Sassy featuring our friends Jenny and Miranda. We just mentioned the Hard Traveling Fanboys. There's Lucha Undead, which is a whole hell of a lot of fun every time those guys are on. So just a plethora of great shows out there. And of course, we got to plug Keith's show. When you headed back to We Talk Comics, Keith, you said you're taking a little break, but when can the people find you again?
I am on hiatus. I'm taking a break as I was on We Talk Comics for 5 years, so I was the only one of the hosts that has not taken a break. So as I catch up on some school and work things, I'm taking a little bit. Probably early January I'll be back, because we'll start doing best ofs and our awards show and that kind of thing. I don't want to miss out on that.
Well, sure. And you guys can where can they find that?
You can find that at wetalkpodcasts.com. Definitely subscribe on iTunes. Search for We Talk Comics, and also available on comicosity.com. I do write occasionally for Comicosity as well. Really, when I have the urge or, you know, a passing thought, I'll put something together.
Shouts to you on that one, because you are my favorite writer at Comicosity. Whenever you have something there, and also shouts to Matt. You and Matt are my two favorite guys working over there. Always enjoy your insights, and even if I happen to disagree with some of it, I still love the insight, and I think that you're both very talented writers. And that always enjoy your material. So. That and speaking of end of year stuff, Kelly and I will be back in January with another top and bottom five, but we're going to do it a little different this time than we usually do. Usually we have to come up with a consensus top and bottom five, but this time we're going to each have our own separate lists as we look back at the year that was 2016, and we count down our top and bottom five ongoing comic book series of the year. So be on the lookout for that in January. And of course, we got some surprises, some stuff in the works. We can't announce it just yet, but a few little things coming up we think some fans out there might be interested in, especially if you happen to be a Green Lantern and or a Wonder Woman fan. So stay tuned for all that. And of course, don't forget to go check out Keith's stuff at Comicosity and then the WeTalkPodcast.com. You can find all of our great podcasts from Place to Be Nation Pop on the Podbean.com feed. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also check out the site PlaceToBeNation.com for everything in comics, movies, music, and of course, the huge amount of pro wrestling content that they have each and every day. It's huge out there, folks. You got to go check this stuff out. But for Kelly Poole, for Keith Kallback, I'm Russell Sellers. Thank you guys for joining us again, and we will see you in 2017.